The title of this presentation tonight is My Journey Towards Feminism, Embracing the Contraries on the Way to Finding the Treasure. I'll leave that up to you a little bit about what the treasure might be. Tonight we're specifically going to talk about liberation and justice for all, seeking a new name, a new map for the journey, and a new road home. I'm Catherine Swanson, daughter of God, created in God's image, and living in God's world in 1989. I'll tell you a little bit more about that too. I'm director of women's programs on the student affairs staff at Cal Lutheran University. I'm an addicted, lifelong student. Most recent class that I took at CLU, and that's one of the perks of my job, is History of Women 482. I still haven't finished my paper for that class. I'm an artist and a poet and a writer. I do those things for my own enjoyment and growth. I'm almost not in any galleries. I was in Festival of Women in the Arts at the college because I juried the show. And I'm hardly published. I have had one poem published in all my life. But I still consider myself an artist, a poet, and a writer because it's what I do. I am also wife of my best friend and partner with whom my journey has been long, 33 years. And full of changing scenery along the way, and over high ups and low downs, and quite exciting and very fulfilling. I am also a mother of four, and co-parent with Byron, of these four grown children, who by some great miracle and gift continue to delight us and teach us and bless us with their love. I'm also a grandmother of one, Andrew David Gwynn, who is just over 2 years old. And we could skip tonight's session and I could show you some pictures if you'd like here. Well, we can do that later, I guess. But I do have plenty if you want to see them. He's the best grandson in the entire world, I'm sure. And I'm also a feminist on a journey. I don't consider myself an authority. In fact, any of you who are feminists and who have studied a lot of the feminist writers probably won't learn anything new tonight, because I'm just simply going to tell my story and how I got where I am. And I don't have any answers, but I have a lot of questions, and I love talking about them. Where our travels intersect, yours and mine, there may be some ahas, or perhaps something in my story will trigger something in yours. As I said, I'm a feminist on a journey. And I'm looking for a new name for this struggle, seeking a new name. I suppose it's a journey toward feminism, but sometimes I'm not altogether happy with that particular word. I sometimes think we need a new word for that. We could think of calling ourselves, this is what I'd really like to, but it doesn't work very well most of the time on Vita because it's too long, but I think I'd like to be a God-centered human beingist instead of a feminist, or in addition to being a feminist, because the feminism I seek is not a reverse discrimination, not a new hierarchy, not a matriarchy in place of a patriarchy, but simply a human beingarchy, I guess. I'm not a linguist, but I think there must be some better word that we could put together that would suggest all of us. I think there's a point, though, where I will still consider myself a feminist in this time in history. I'm looking for a new creation, a new order, something that's more collaborative, something that is a partnership, something that talks about mutuality, something that is connected, human, attached, responsible, caring, We need a new name. But for now, I'm a feminist on a journey. And that reminds me, we also need a new map. Now, my husband and I have spent 33 years arguing about how you hold a map. I hold it the direction I'm going, so that north is this way, and he holds it with north always at the top, which means that I have to stand on my head if we're going south. Anyway, we disagree on our maps, but we need them. Also, we cannot go by just old maps. Every year, Byron goes down to the AAA and gets us updated maps. Now, not always are the new roads on them, but most of the time they are. Anyway, we've decided that old maps won't do. They're outdated, falling apart. We need new glasses, and nowadays, because I'm a card-carrying member of the AARP, I have to have a magnifying glass in the car to read them. And we need new discoveries, or these maps help us make new discoveries. Every summer we go back to Colorado and spend some time there, and after 10 years of driving back and forth between Colorado and California, it could get mighty boring. So we go off on new tangents every time. We determine that we will not take the whole same road every year, so we go different ways. We need maps to do that. We need new directions, new guidelines. Some of our roads will not be so terribly four-lane-ish. Some of our roads are barely visible on the map because they're such a light color. I think the worse the road, the lighter the color they make it on the map. But at least we need a new map for the journey. For me, the new maps for feminism, for my journey into feminism, have been books and people that I've run across. I have the good fortune of being at the Women's Resource Center at Cal Lutheran, and as the director of that, and since we have no staff that lasts beyond the last day of school because my staff is students, I get to order all the books. And so I have quite a fun time after school's out, before my contract is over in the summer, ordering new books. And I have a wonderful library of books by feminist writers with feminist perspectives on a variety of subjects. Having an interest specifically in the theology, I have a lot in that area, and we encourage women and men, students at the university, to come in, and when they're writing papers, to consider the feminist perspective in whatever field of study they are. So new books become new roadmaps for this journey. There's a lot of them in the library here. There's I looked up under feminism, there's quite a selection in this library, and also in the tape library there are quite a few tapes on feminism, and one of them I couldn't find, and Karen was so kind to make a new copy of the tape. So if you don't find it, just ask the people in the tape ministry and they'll be able to help you find it. There are also quite a few books on feminism in the bookstore, and I would urge you to check out any of these here while you're up here, and when you get home, check out your local library, your local university, and hopefully your church library will have some books too on this important subject, and those become new maps for us in the journey and in the struggle. So we will probably continue on now with a definition of what feminism is. I don't have an easy answer. In fact, I rewrite the definition every time I do this. I can't find one that's just exactly perfect. But I feel myself that as a woman created by God in God's image, and as a Christian seeking to live in fully in response to God's amazing grace, I believe that feminism is essential. It's grounded in the gospel, and it's got to be a part of our Christian life. But if it's going to be so essential, we have to define it. And at CLU not too long ago, maybe 3 or 4 years ago, we had the privilege of hearing Virginia Raimi Mollenkott, who has written several books, one of them I think I have here, the new version of her book, Women, Men, and the Bible, and she's written several others. She came to the university and talked to us and said something about feminism is the theory of the political, economic, and social equality of the sexes, along with organized activity on behalf of women's rights and interests, political, economic, and social equality of the sexes. But Mollenkopf also adds, I am using the word feminism in exactly these senses with the understanding that what the Bible teaches as best for women will also be best for men and the children with whom they relate. Feminism is beneficial to all humankind. And that idea has been one of the seed thoughts that has so influenced me in my own journey, that as I strive towards this goal or this direction in my journey towards feminism, I really think of it as not what's best for me as a woman, but what is best for all humankind. And that's why the journey is so exciting, because it's not something that I would do alone. Conversely, however, feminism in church and society grows out of a refusal by many women and some men to accept the ancient principle that men are primary or more important than women as human beings. That ancient principle is a social organization called patriarchy. The father is head of the house or clan or nation. Men govern, make the laws, make the decisions, have the power. Though some things are changing ever so slightly, it's still, I would suggest, a patriarchal society we live in, and still a patriarchal church we call our own. Most Old Testament authors assume that patriarchy is the will of God for the social order. They assume men should have absolute power over their families, over worship, and over society in general. In the New Testament, patriarchal assumptions are the same, but with some notable exceptions. Number one, Christ's personal behavior. Two, the ministry of certain women in the early church. The many passages that speak in the New Testament of mutuality, and several prophetic passages which look at the regenerative effects of the gospel in human society. That makes it pretty clear that we can no longer say that since patriarchy was the cultural background of the scriptures, it is therefore fundamental for us, any more than we say that since there was slavery in the scriptures, that's fundamental for us, or since there was absolute monarchy in the culture of the scriptures, that therefore it's fundamental for us. We have to be consistent about de-absolutizing the biblical culture. So biblical feminism asks that modern Christians concern themselves with fulfilling a society that has been regenerated by the power of the gospel, instead of clinging to a sinful social order into which the gospel was first introduced. In other words, a new creation. My favorite definition of feminism comes from the article Jesus is a Feminist by Leonard Swidler. And I have made copies and copies of this for friends because it was so meaningful to me. I got a hold of it, I think, out of an old ALC packet for women that Marge Wold had put together years ago. I think it was in that packet. Anyway, it's been a very meaningful article to me. And the thesis of it was that Jesus was a feminist. This was written by a man. He was the editor of the Ecumenical Studies and a member of the religion department at Temple University in Philadelphia. And he defines terms this way. Jesus was a historical person who lived in Palestine 2,000 years ago, whom Christians traditionally acknowledge as Lord and Savior, and whom they should imitate as much as possible. A feminist is a person who is in favor of and who promotes the equality of men with women, A person who advocates and practices treating women primarily as human persons, as men are so treated, and willingly contravenes social custom in so acting. I guess that's been etched on my mind ever since I first read it. It's an interesting article too, but that definition just really strikes home that Jesus was a feminist. In fact, those words just keep ringing in my mind along this journey. I guess I keep seeing signs on the way. So far as we can tell, that Jesus never said or did anything which would indicate that he advocated treating women inferior to men. But that on the contrary, he said and did things which indicated that he thought women as equals, thought of women as equals of men, and that in the process, he willingly violated pertinent social customs and social mores, I guess. I'd like to give you this challenge, and I'd like to suggest that we read the four Gospels, remembering what the status of women in Palestine was at that particular time, and make note of all the positive, affirming, trusting, believing ways that Jesus treated women. I think that's, I've started on that exercise, haven't finished it, but I think it's an exciting exercise that gives a lot of strength and fuel for the journey. We look at Christian feminism then as a vision for a new humanity, a new creation, another more exciting way. It's clearly, again, not a reverse discrimination. Some of the feminist theologians that I've read, and many of them are so exciting and so challenging and stimulating, but some of them have chosen to say that the church is hopelessly patriarchal, and therefore they've chosen to think that it's not possible to stay within it. But there's also a large body of believers and feminist theologians who choose to stay within the church, to hang in there. And I guess that's where I find myself. I'm not going to give up on the church. It means too much to me. I think there are things in our journey together that need to be changed, but I don't want to give up on it yet. So in our ordinary journeys, we keep talking about these issues and hoping that our dear and our beloved church will grow. I guess I started off by saying that this was going to be my own journey toward feminism, and sometimes when I've talked to women's groups, people have said, how in the world can you be, you know, 55 and come out of such a traditional background as you did and be what sometimes they or sometimes myself consider a radical feminist. Now, I'm not radical in terms of some people's definition of radical, but if radical means willing to change and willing to instigate change, then I guess I'm glad to be called that. So I'll tell you a little bit about my own journey and how I got here. I grew up in a very traditional Augustana Lutheran pastor's home. Mother and father had a very traditional marriage. I never remember my father ever cooking or anything, but I do remember my mom spending a great deal of her time in the kitchen, and Saturday night was the day that we cleaned up. We all had our duties to do. Dad wrote his sermon. Mother baked breads and pies and things so that she wouldn't have to cook on Sunday. Saturday night we took our baths and worked on our memory verses, and I don't know how many of you are old enough to remember these kind of things, but it was just a real traditional growing up time. My childhood was Ruth and Sager are models of traditional loving parents and traditional role stereotypes, and they've been part of my growth pattern too. They've been part of my journey. Then I thought about growing up and what I would do when I grew up. And in those days, usually what women did was either be a secretary, a nurse, or a teacher. I mean, those were the options, basically. Maybe a missionary, but basically, those were the options open to us. And we were going to go to college, and we were going, and when I say we, it's because I have a twin sister. We were going to go to college, we were going to find a man, and he was going to be a Lutheran pastor, and we were going to get married, and we were going to have them be parish pastors on either side of a, I mean, we were going to, they were going to be co-pastors of a church, and we were going to live in parsonages on either side of this church. I mean, we had our dreams. Then we were going to have children, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. This was the vision that we had in the 50s. We went to youth conferences, and we were committed to serving the church. I remember meeting with Wilton Bergstrand, who was one of the early leaders, I think, here at Holden, but also he was the youth director of the old Augustana Synod. And there was always a great call at these youth conferences to work in the vocations of the church. But in those days, that didn't mean to be a pastor for a woman. It meant to be a parish worker or a parish secretary or something like that. And I remember Wilton coming to our college when we were at Bethany College in Lindsberg, Kansas, and I was planning to be a teacher, and he said, but if you don't go into church work now, you'll never go into church work. I mean, the assumption was that if you didn't do it right away, you were going to get married and you'd never do anything else. So anyway, I went after college to become director of Christian education at House of Prayer Lutheran Church in Minneapolis. Well, it was in Richfield. So I had a Minnesota year in my life. I did just what the expectations were for young women. I met Byron, and he swept me off my feet, and I got married and became a pastor's wife. And that was what I wanted. I mean, I am glad. I wouldn't change my life for anything, but I'm glad things have changed since. We spent our first years of marriage in a small congregation in Kansas City, and had a couple kids, and Byron went back to graduate school, and I learned some things by osmosis. It was wonderful. It was a great time in our lives. Then we had a few more kids and a few more years of graduate school, and moved to Nebraska where he was teaching. And we had these four children, this white house with shutters and a yard in front and a yard in back, and it was pretty typical, pretty traditional. And I cooked and took care of things like that, and Byron went outside the house and taught, and we were very, very happy. I don't put that down at all. I'm appreciative of the women who make that kind of choice in their lives, but my twin sister, who had lived out on the coast after we were married, after she was married and I was married, came one day and she said she'd been struggling with some issues, and she was talking about the language issue and how, you know, it was pretty important to use inclusive language. And I remember saying to her, that's just nitpicking. I mean, what difference does it make? I know man means all of us, and et cetera, et cetera. And my sister and I grew up fighting. I mean, the folks used to put good silverware and tablecloth on the table if there was a whole day that we didn't fight. So we've always fought about things, and it's been a wonderful relationship. We talked about that, and that was my very first introduction that I can remember on my road to feminism. She just sort of started saying some things, and it got to me, and I started arguing with her, and then I had to think about it, and then I had to read about it, and she went off back to wherever she was going, and I was still thinking about it, and things didn't settle down inside my soul. I began to think that maybe there was something about what she had said that was right, and got more and more interested in that. And then I heard that the bishop in Nebraska was going to have a task force on women in church and society. And the bishop was going to appoint a committee, so he did, and he asked me if I'd be on the committee, and we got to the committee, and here was a committee on women in church and society, and there was a male pastor that was chairperson of this committee. We thought that was kind of strange. Well, this male chairperson was really a sensitive guy. He was one of these feminists, and he came to the first meeting and resigned. And that was another thing that impressed me a whole lot, because I wondered what that meant. And he said, well, you know, that this shouldn't be, that I shouldn't be the chair of this committee, but I really want to still be on it. And he stayed on and was a really wonderful contributing member of that committee all the way through. But that task force on women in church and society in Nebraska really was the formation, were the formation days for me in my struggle. We had one pastor at that time in the whole Nebraska Synod that was a woman. And we had this great goal of having 5 by 85. I mean, that was like 10 years later, it was going to be 5 by 85. And there were congregations all over that didn't want to consider, in Nebraska, that didn't want to consider a woman for pastor at that time. So beginning to work on that struggle and that issue was a real healthy part of my formation. And then I was elected chair of the committee and was sent to a national convention and got in touch with women all over the country from a variety of synods that were dealing with these issues. And I guess that's where I really got wound up on the subject, that seeing these women struggling to be all that they could be and being held down, not being able to be who they wanted to be because custom or tradition or the church said, we're not ready for that yet. Then we moved to California, and I figured that moving from Nebraska to California, there would be all kinds of things going on in our synod out there on these issues. And I happened to be at a convention, and there was a woman there who was the first lay woman who was member of a synod staff. And I said to her, Ruth, how come they don't have a task force on women in this particular synod? She said, well, there used to be one years ago, but it kind of just died out from lack of support. And she said, why don't you start one? And so we did. We called together a group of people. Jan Bowman, Jerry Swanson's wife that'll be here later in the summer, was one of those persons, and several lay and clergy women from the area. And we formed a committee called the Task Force on the Partnership of Women and Men. No, I guess, well, I don't know what it was called, but anyway, it was something like that. And we started working on these issues in our own synod, trying to see how we could be supportive to the lay women who were wanting to work in the church and be a part of the church and have their voices heard in the church, trying to encourage committees to be more inclusive in terms of both women and men in membership, the executive committee of the synod, the executive board of the synod, trying to make that more inclusive and more equitable. And then we existed for a couple years, and we discovered that the ALC, I was former LCA, and we discovered that the ALC had a committee like that too. Well, you know how it is with women. We thought, it'd be a good idea if we got together. And so we did, and that was our merger. I mean, we did not have to go through a CNLC committee or a committee of 70 or a jillion years and a bunch of things. We just decided to merge, and we did it. So then for the last 4 years before the big merger, we were a merged committee of ALC and LCA, and it was an exciting and wonderful time in my life. What influenced me most there was the women in the women pastors who were sharing their own journeys and their struggles and their desires to be a part of the church and to be heard, and not being able to receive calls or not having the affirmation or the support of their brothers in the ministry in many places. And so, and yet they never gave up. They had so much hope and so much courage and so much enthusiasm that it was catching, and so I guess that was one of the things that made my desire to stay in the church and to work hard within the church so strong, was knowing those wonderful women. In our own local congregation, we have We had, for a long time, we had the traditional LCW Bible study circles, and that's been a very meaningful part of my life. I've learned a whole lot about the Bible and about other women through those circles. But there were a group of us in our church that felt that we were hungry for a chance to discuss some of the more controversial theological issues for women. And so we just decided that we would start a theological circle. One of the women in the church said, "Oh, if you call it that, nobody will come." But we decided to call it that because that's what we intended to be. And it was amazing. It's been quite a large circle, and we've kept on. There's been a lot of enthusiasm for it. One of our first books that we discussed was All We're Meant to Be by Nancy Hardesty and Phyllis Manzoni, which is a biblical book about Christian feminism. Another part of my journey then was to travel with Byron to Mexico and Central America and to think in terms of the liberation issues, in terms of both feminist liberation and liberation theology in general. I met a lot of women in those Central American countries that were extremely strong and extremely pushed down by the machismo society in which they live, unable to really have their voices heard, and yet at the same time determined not to make that a continuing habit. So some of them have been real inspirations in my life. It's been a time of excitement and creativity, a time of to learn and to grow, and to learn new words and new language, new images for God. We'll be talking about that in some of the other sessions. I've been helped by the vision of kitchen table theology that some of the women, I think it's Letty, is it Letty Russell that talks about kitchen table theology? Phyllis Tribble, one of the writers is working on that now and talks about how theology, it's such an encompassing theology. It's round and nourishing and delicious, and it's a chance to sit and talk together. And those kind of images of that women can bring to the theological discussions and to our own growth together are exciting to me. Another one is the Letty Russell's Household of Freedom. And the whole image of household, the idea of good housekeeping, mending the church, the authority in the shared community, partnership and mutuality. That's an exciting part of my own journey. And even though the glimpses of partnership are not always present, and they're sometimes very few and far between, they are a genuine invitation to the freedom of Jesus Christ, whose love and acceptance sets us free to bear our own burdens and those of our neighbors in mutual housekeeping. I suppose my favorite verse in all the Bible, at least currently, I keep changing, but right now my favorite verse is Galatians 3:28. And it talks there about there is neither Jew nor Greek, neither male nor female, neither slave nor free, for you are all one in Christ Jesus. And I guess that kind of summarizes my own philosophy in terms of liberation. And I wrote a while back the only poem that I've ever had published, which is kind of the statement of my philosophy, and I'll use that to close my part of this tonight, and then I'd like to hear what some of your reactions and your own particular journeys are and your ideas of what feminism is. But this sort of summarizes my own philosophy of liberation. I am one and you another. I am sister, you are brother. Woman, man, God created. Human beings, loved, related, both alive, each unique. Both are strong, each is weak. Person human, celebrated. All God's children, liberated. Thank you. Now, let me hear from you. Tell me about your journey, your ideas of feminism, your reactions.
Yeah. I heard Rhianne Eisler speak recently.
The Chalice and the Blade?
Yeah. Uh-huh. And she's strong on this partnership idea. Mm-hmm. And she calls it partnership over the domination role. And she applies it in a broad sweep to foreign relations and world peace.
Yeah, in fact, we'll be talking a little bit about that, that whole concept in the one on Wednesday. Where we talk about, the one on Wednesday is called Equality of Women and Men is a Prerequisite to World Peace. And I think it's the whole idea of partnership. One of the other women theologians writes a lot about partnership. I've read part of Rhianne's book and would like to read the rest of it. Yeah. Neat concept. Someone else?
I consider myself feminist by your definition, but I'm sometimes confused by women who consider themselves feminists, some of whom seem to want to hold on, as I do, to old patterns of chivalry. Other women are angry if you open the door for them or do something like that. What is your...
Oh dear, what do I think about chivalry? I suppose that's a hard one. I guess my own personal feeling is that well-intended chivalry is certainly a gift that someone gives to another. I think if it becomes a way of having power over someone, which I'm sure it wouldn't for you, but for some people it might, where it means, you know, it's like the old image of women on a pedestal that, you know, you put women up there and you sort of separate them and then that gives you the power because you're the one that puts them up there. That kind of a thing. I guess I would have some problem with that. There are times when I open the door for Byron, and there are times when he opens it for me, and I guess we're both chivalrous, maybe. I know some people get really upset with things. My own feeling about feminism is that well-intended and sincere gifts to each other need to be, you know, accepted and understood for what they are. But if it prevents me from... If it's something other than opening a door, if it's something that prevents me from being who I can be as an independent and person, you know, if it takes away my chances to be strong, then I'd have problems with it too. There are times when I'm strong and times when I'm weak, and the same with each of us. And I don't know if that helps, but that's how I deal with that issue.
It's interesting that you spoke about your experience meeting women down in Central America. Shuni Hartwig from St. Olaf attended the UN conference the year that the Year of the Women, 4 years ago? And there the issues for many in America were inclusive language, and that was so far ahead from what women were struggling with from other underdeveloped nations, where they just want economic.
Right, survival,
right.
And equality. A person that deals with that book, with that issue that in an interesting way is Bärbel von Wartenberg Potter. I don't know, it's just a new book that I picked up. It's called Global Sisterhood and God's Song. We Will Not Hang Our Harp on the Willows. And she points out, as do many feminists, that sisterhood is global. And if we think in terms of our own white, upper, middle class liberation movement, and without thinking of global sisterhood, we won't lose. we won't have it. It won't last. And so I think an awareness of that. And another person that deals with that is Carter Hayward. Hayward talks about that in Our Passion for Justice, Images of Power, Sexuality, and Liberation. And they both talk about that idea that for third world women, the issues may be different, but that when we think in terms of liberation for ourselves, we need to be aware of what that means all the way around the world and not just for ourselves here. And that's what I learned a lot of that in Central America. I mean, you know, we were confronted with that continually. Like the whole idea of living in a machismo or a macho society presents a lot of problems that, well, there are those that would say we have the same thing here, but I think it's different in Central America. And some of the things that, you know, they don't want to change, all of the things they want. An ability to be able to work and survive, and those are important things to them, as they are to all of us, but maybe in a different way. Yeah.
Could you just go on a little bit more of that? I was just living in Japan, and in general, it doesn't seem that there's a desire or whatever it takes to start the desire for feminism in Japan or changes. And it's a different system.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't really, it's not the same as it. On the outside it looks like it, but it's a very, it's a different system.
Sure.
What role does an American feminist have supporting people within that country? Or how do you see yourself relating to a country where there isn't really a feminist movement, but without a real equality?
Yeah, you know, that's an issue that I'd really like some help on myself, because I keep reading about the idea that it won't do us any good to consider our own liberation without considering our sisters all over the world. I'm not sure exactly how, you know, the methods for getting at that. I think I guess a global consciousness is something that we have to continually work on, and thinking in terms of this as God's whole human family. And therefore, you know, I guess if you use the image of family, if one child is just interested in her welfare all the time and just, you know, take care of me, take care of me, take care of me, without paying attention to her sisters and brothers, you know, in the other part of the family, that person is going to become very self-centered. So I guess becoming more and more aware of our sisters' needs and doing what we can, and we can't do for them, but we can listen to them and learn from them in a variety of ways.
I'm wondering, we're in a situation where at least overtly there's no asking for help.
Yeah.
There's no yeah. overt asking for change.
Not anywhere in Japan?
Well, within a very small minority.
Uh-huh.
I'm not saying that there isn't a deep desire. Mm-hmm. I'm saying at least overtly there's very little to connect with.
I don't know how that would work there. I know that there were women in Central America who were working to convince their sisters that getting out of the trap of living in an oppressed and macho society was possible, and not every woman was aware of that. I remember when we had dinner at Medardo Gomez's house, and his wife was telling us about her work with the women in the church, and how many of them just accepted the society just as it was and thought they had no hope, and how she and those of the other women that were working with her were trying to help them understand that they could get out of that kind of a situation, and that they could grow and develop as human beings, and that they had potential within them. In fact, it was really interesting. I guess Medardo was a Missouri Synod pastor before or had been in that, and he said that that tie was getting farther and farther apart because of his wife, because you know, she was in favor of ordination of women and a variety of things that the Missouri Synod Church still hadn't come to. So he was saying that because of his wife and their work with the women, that he had grown in terms of his own concept of it. And I know that there was a woman who was teaching in, we talked to her in Mexico, and she said that that many women, Mexican women, didn't even think about the issues of liberation, but they would go out and, in order to survive, work for other women and clean their houses. And she said that one of her tasks was to go and tell the women that were hiring the poor women that you have to pay your sisters fairly. You can't, you know, bleed them to death. And so she was raising the consciousness of the people who could pay to have their house cleaned. And then she was saying to the women who were hustling, don't be content to accept, you know, just the pittance, because your sister needs to pay you fairly. So there's, you know, there's that constant work within a country to help each other understand that things don't have to stay that way. I don't know if that's helpful, but
I think what you were saying is giving a vision of what's possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the possibilities. There was a comment that I got so excited about that I jotted down, and then I forgot to jot down where I found it, so I can't even tell you what this is from, but it was, we have vocations to live, ministries to fulfill, selves bursting open with God's own possibilities for us. And I guess that's, you know, that's what we can do is help each of our sisters understand that we're just, all of us, men and women alike, are full of God's possibilities for ourselves and for what we can be. Remember, Jerry Swanson's son was the senior class president, and the student body president at CLU, and he just graduated, and his senior speech at graduation was so impressive. He said, people are going around asking seniors what you're going to do, and he said, I'd rather the question be what you're going to be. And I think that helping each other see what we can be is one way to continue. And by what I said earlier in terms of my own journey, being what we can be doesn't mean that everybody has to go out and have the same kind of a job, or a job outside the home, or a job inside the home, or whatever. I don't want to suggest in my own journey that I am in any way putting down people that choose to stay home and be a parent to a child, whether it be a man that chooses to be a house father or a woman who chooses to be a house mother or whatever. I don't want to put down that choice at all. That's one choice. The idea is that we have the choice to do it, and not that we're expected by someone else to do something. So, you know, just, I guess, to see all the possibilities that are within us, and that God, the gifts that God has given us, and to be able to use them in healthy ways. Yes?
A book that we had used at church about a year ago, was called Shalom Woman.
Uh-huh. By Margaret Wolfe.
Right. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the things that has stuck in my mind through the book was the fact that in the third world, these women did not have a name, Margaret or Barbara. They were just called woman. And that was like, this can't be true, but it is. They weren't even known as an individual.
Mm-hmm.
And above all things in the book, that was the thing that just really floored me.
Mm-hmm. And I think that being named is really important, and, you know, not hey you, but, or hey woman, or whatever, you know. Or the way they used to say, well, the wife will take care of that. I mean, as though...
So we do that to the men, too. We say, well, my husband will take care of that. Uh-huh. So maybe sometimes we should use the name and...
Call each other by name.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was really interesting how our identities... In other days, we're often tied up with our husbands. My mother-in-law was a sweet woman, but she never wanted me to address envelopes May Swanson. She wanted to be Mrs. Ralph Swanson. That was where she got her identity. And I have a principle now that I, when I address Christmas cards to people that happen to be couples, I just always use both their first names. That's really important to me because I say Betty and Bill Swanson or whoever. I mean, I just always do that. And but my mother-in-law didn't want that. She was content with the other kind of system. So, yeah.
Catherine, it's interesting you mentioned that. I'm financial secretary of my congregation, and one of the things we have recently gotten the Lutheran Church Information System, whatever that's called, that takes care of all the financial membership aspects of the congregation. It's all on computer. And one of the things I've done, or tried to do, with some success, is to... Well, one of the capabilities of this computer system just recently is to get both members of a husband-wife team or whatever, both names printed on contribution statements and whatnot.
Good.
If the church desires to do that.
Well, whether or not the church desires to do it, it would be a good way to begin a consciousness.
Yeah. But one of the things that I've also done as well is to alphabetize the husband and wife's name.
Mm-hmm.
I think you just said Betty and Bill, mm-hmm. which is how I would list it, because Betty comes in the alphabet before Bill.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd expected to hear some feedback from that or some objections. There haven't been any, at least to me. I don't know if there's been any objections to other people or not.
That's great. All those steps, I think, just little by little, things become more equal. If we say things, you know, in more inclusive language, and we'll be talking about language a little bit on Friday, but we say things in language that it becomes more and more comfortable to say it that way rather than Mr. I mean, I never got introduced as, or Byron never got introduced as Mr. Catherine Swanson, but I used to get introduced as Mr. Byron Swanson. Well, we don't do that anymore, you know. I mean, Mrs. Byron Swanson. We don't do that anymore. It's you know, and if we get used to it, and I hope that some of you young people up in the peanut gallery, did you call it up there? Owen. will you know, be thinking about those kind of issues. One of the things that I am so surprised at CLU is that some of the younger women think that because, you know, the men in their life dry dishes and their mother or the women that they know go outside the home and work, that all of the issues are taken care of. It isn't true. There's a long way to go. Did you raise your hand?
Well, I wouldn't, but perhaps you could... comment on why the political gains for women have been rather modest, even considering they're numerically superior, I mean, larger numbers of women, and the goals of the movement seem to be so obvious for of the benefits to the women. I would have expected more political power.
Yeah, I would have too. I guess that's a question that I'd like to have some more insight. One of the things is that not all women are united on the issues. And I think that, and this might be painful to say, but I think that that the church has been partly to blame for that. I mean, there has been a group of churches that have said that woman's place is in the home, and they're not talking about the House of Representatives or the Senate, and you know, and I think that there are a large number of women who have bought into that, and you know, have that has probably helped the status quo. I think it has to do with a lot of other, you know, some political things that it's probably pretty costly to have equality, because
in fact, if you look at the IR, the Equal Rights in the Assembly, Richfield, what, 5 years ago, every one of the states where it failed, where the Deep South, where the Southern Baptists dominate, and that's a biblical literalism, and the Mormon states, Utah, Nevada, Arizona, you know, those were the states where it didn't pass, and it's probably because of that understanding, that biblical literalism.
So I would guess that would be one of the reasons. I don't know what else. I know when it comes in terms of, and this is an extreme generalization, but when it comes to the idea of equality of women and men in terms of being a prerequisite for peace, we'll be talking about that. That you know, it's pretty costly for our country to think of peace breaking out all over. I mean, you know, it's going to cost a lot of jobs. You know, so there's probably a lot of intertwined economic issues that have had to do with that too. But my own personal assumption is that maybe the religious issues are the worst.
I come from England, and we were very pleased when Margaret Thatcher initially was elected. As women, we thought that at last we've got some sort of power. But in fact, all that has happened is that she has developed male attributes of aggressiveness and not brought any female attributes at all.
Mm-hmm.
And in order for women to get by in politics at the moment, they really have to fight a man's game.
And that's also true, I think, a lot for women in business, that oftentimes they have bought into the male structures and the male methods and ways of doing things and sold out in a sense to that in order to get into leadership positions. Not everyone, certainly not everyone. I just read an article recently about, called, I believe it was Beyond Macho, and it was saying that women are interested in bringing a new kind of management skill to business, but that's not easy. I mean, in the first place, in order to bring a new management style to business, you have to be a manager. And to get to be a manager, sometimes you end up playing the game. So, you know, it's kind of a catch-22. And I don't know where the answer is. I guess persistence. One of the women writers was talking about it's worth the fight, and we might have to die for it. You know, die to to get what she says. It may be well that many of us will live our entire lives to make one point, that women are people of God. And I think that sometimes, and she talks too about, to this end, to this deeply spiritual and profoundly political end, that we are called by God to live, and if need be, to die. So it's not an easy struggle. I mean, you know, there will be a lot of pain along the way, along the journey. But I think we must realize actively that we are meant by God, in whose image we are created, to come into our own and to help others do the same. If we take the risen Christ seriously as alive and well and active among us, then we know well what Paul meant when he proclaimed, "There is neither Jew nor Greek, there is neither slave nor free, there is neither male nor female, for you are all one in Christ Jesus." Come along on the journey.